Thank you. I'd like to introduce our next presenter, Dr. Raman Asghari.
Yep.
And he is currently a faculty in the Department of Population Health,
yes.
New York University School of Medicine. He's a member of Board of Directors, Doctors Without Borders USA. His areas of expertise include global health education, international humanitarian assistance and relief work, with an emphasis on refugees, situations and ethics, and the health care of the homeless, immigrants, and asylum seekers. Raman has worked as medical coordinator with Doctors Without Borders and other international organizations since 1997. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And thank you. Let me see if I can actually use wine. Yes. Okay, so there is no conflict of interest to report. Thank you so much for coming today. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background regarding the numbers and the statistics for the homeless and homeless health care. I imagine this is a self-selected group of people, but I think it's a good idea to just go over some of them. So we have around somewhere between 3 to 4 million of homeless persons in the United States. It's interesting to know that the majority of homeless actually live in shelter, so they are not necessarily on the street. I mean, they occasionally do. And so that has to do really something with the potential for access. That's the reason that I actually emphasize that. In New York City, we have around close to 30,000 of adult homeless, so we're not talking about the family. That number is much higher. And that they use the shelter system. And generally, folks really lose their house because there's the problem with paying rents, and they have family disputes. And primarily mental health probably is the most common reason for more a chronic form of homelessness, but it's not really a major part. So obviously, when people are in the shelter system, it becomes a vicious cycle. Then, you know, they get exposures and potential of substance abuse and mental health after they lost their home, and it kind of become a vicious cycle. In New York City, that's basically the ethnic background of ethnic and racial background of the population that we see. Around 57% of African American are black, and the rest. Men are at higher risk to become homeless, but certainly there are close to 30% of the homeless population are women. The problem with the homeless, everybody knows, is a recurring issue because it has to do with the fundamental social issues that put people out of their home in the first place. And when you look at the numbers, at least in New York City, we see that for each episode of homelessness, people really stay, 35% of them, they stay within the shelter system for close to a year, around 66% at least up to 6 months. And the reason I'm mentioning that because that's an opportunity to potentially intervene at the shelter level. For 35% of homeless are above age of 45, and they're basically getting to their 50s. And the reason that I'm mentioning that because they are actually due for a lot of preventive care that are age-related, and that usually has been ignored in general preventive health care, as well as management of the chronic diseases. Cancer and cardiovascular disease actually are among the top two leading causes of death, mortality among the homeless age 45 and above. And they have a higher rate of the cancer mortality if they get a cancer compared to general population, and obviously they have a wide range of potential risk factors that increases their chance of for cardiovascular disease as well as different type of cancers. And you probably know the comparatively higher rate of mental health and substance abuse and alcohol abuse. So obviously they are facing, we're going to get to the point, so bear with me. Obviously they are facing multiple levels of barriers at the individual and health system and the provider level. I want to emphasize really for the provider level, we have our own biases, physician, practitioners, health professionals, and that is going to cause significant barrier for the population to have access to our potential medical services we provide, and at the individual level, obviously, in the system. The problem really with addressing the healthcare of the homeless, at least from my point of view, is that we have been focusing so much on providing urgent care for them and completely forget the health education measures and preventive measures for them. And that's a potential, there are potential venues that we can use to improve their health education and access for chronic disease and preventive care. There is this perception that, you know, if someone is homeless now, they're going to get their act together, that's their priority, and then they're going to go and have home, and hopefully they can go and address all of those things. But the reality tells us people coming back to the system again and again, and they're going to be underemployed, they're not going to have a social capital, and they're really going to struggle with the same problems that in the first place put them on the street. So I'll give you a couple, three or four other kind of a snapshot of the research that we have done in New York City regarding a chronic disease to build the case for mHealth, which is really the main topic. And we did in a study, we looked at colorectal cancer screening. You know, nobody really thinks about the cancer screening for the homeless. You know, I have written grants that I, some of the feedback that I have got is that, well, you know, they die much earlier. So they're not going to even make it to the age range. They're going to be, you know, potential for a cancer screening. And that's insane for me. I mean, it's just that argument is insane. So we look at the data, we notice that only less than 20% of them, they are up to date for colorectal cancer screening based on the age. And the population that we serve, the average age is like 61, 62 years old, you know? And when we look at what was the reason, is that they were actually provided provider canceling. So neither of the mental health, nor insurance status, nor substance or alcohol abuse, because all the time, we kind of have this stigma attached to them. They think because they have all of those issues, they're not going to actually be welcoming. And that's not true. When we look at our data, this is more than 400 people. You know, you have to provide for them a counseling that is adjusted to the barrier that they face. You know, if you just give them, you know, you're supposed to get their cancer screening, and this is a referral to the, you know, gastroenterologist, it's not going to happen for them. Of course they're going to decline it because we are not addressing their barriers. We did the same thing for breast cancer. Look at the numbers. And the numbers, you know, nationwide numbers are close to 85% of being up to date, and for them it's 59%, equal to the low-income non-homeless population using the same centers. The problem here is that even the screening loops is not closed. They get the screening, but they don't know the result. You know, they're a mobile population. Obviously, they don't have a permanent address, and there's a difficulty with the health system to really get back to them the information that they need. So it was really, you know, less than 59% because 50% of them didn't know. We did the same thing for cervical cancer screening. You know, it's a self-reported, 76% of them, they said, I got my pap smear. I'm up to date, okay? The problem is that 65% of those who got the cancer, they have no idea what was the result. They never followed up. Again, because there's a big gap here of a communication between the system, health system, and the homeless. Look at the lack of a knowledge. Up to 50% of them, they really didn't know how often they have to get a pap smear. They didn't know any relationship with it. What are the causes of the cervical cancer? And when you look at the HPV knowledge and attitude, significantly lower. You know, more than 40%, they had never heard of HPV. And the average age for this population was 42 years old. And didn't know it's a sexually transmitted disease. And didn't actually know that HPV causes a cervical cancer among those folks who actually knew what is HPV. Like heard about it, not knew what is HPV. And then you can look at the relationship between not really having a pap smear up to date and the knowledge regarding both the frequency of pap smear and that. So, we know that there are mobile population, we know that they are facing multiple barriers to access to healthcare, we know that problem with permanent address and communication is an issue. What we don't know is that we have no idea what's their perception and attitude and experience of mobile health or just the mobile technology. It's very difficult to find some information. If you do the PubMed search, I think maybe you get five or six. I don't even think you get five or six, maybe two or three, a couple of them. And we thought that it's actually nice to really get their perception and attitude and experience because we can use that potentially to mitigate some of these barriers that they have to the health education and access to health care. So what we did a qualitative study, which is overlooked a lot of time, but the population really faced significant marginalization. Semi-structured interviews with the 50 homeless. We kind of stayed on the side. We wanted to have a focus group, but it was not really something that they were open to it, and they preferred, obviously, individual semi-structure. And that's what we basically did to explore their perception and attitude regarding mHealth for any form of the medical service. that's the age range. So average is 51. Close to 60% were female. A little bit overrepresentative, obviously, because the population of men are more. But honestly, we approached 67, and we got approved. You know, agreed to participate 50, and the majority of those who didn't want to basically participate were men. There is clearly issue with being a man. Yeah. So 20% of them, they have mental illness. Of this population, 60% they had some form of a chronic disease, including a mental illness. And average years of homelessness, it was 2 years. So they really have been around for a while. 5 minutes. Oh, my God. So we asked about the ownership of cell phones and using text messages. Majority of the women and men really had a working cell phone. They had ability to send and receive text messages on their phone. And that's the code. I'm not going to read the code, but I'm going to give you a second to read it. Most of the participants, at least for at least some years, they had the phone or they kept it. So some were between two to five years, and they actually knew how to use it. Usually they kept actually the same phone number, and the reason you can see that, they actually use the same phone number because they don't have a landline, and this is really a way for them to communicate with any potential social support that they have. And another thing was that most of our participants, close at least 2/3 of them, they really got this Obamacare, that's what they call a phone, which is, you know, right now, if they're eligible for Medicaid, they get that. And they basically save the minutes for a lot of things that is very important for them. And they consider actually health a priority for them. And a very minority of of this group, they actually kind of like receive services from their friend or family member. Sorry for this layout. Look at the perception and attitude toward the text messaging to improve their medical care and access. Across the age group, for women, they really liked it. You can read it. Hell yeah, you know, of course. It's like, you know, it makes sense. It's almost like why you're even asking this question, but it was good to hear it from them. And the fact that they could actually, for text messaging, they could record it and they can use it later. And overwhelmingly, both men and women prefer the simple text messages because we looked at the content and the format. And it was interesting that they really didn't like so much of motivational text messaging. They wanted something very straightforward. And so you let them know what's going on. You know, this last one is just say you have an appointment, give me a time, address, and everything. And all of the extra shit distracts me. You know, it was like across the board. And free phone. So the question was, what do you think if you actually provide it to you? And if there's some kind of a form that you, a phone and plan that you can use. And obviously, as you can see, they really kind of welcomed that. And the perception was that it's going to improve their access to health care. You know, that's an example. That would be great. There were cases of a man that really had an issues with kind of this fatalistic views toward the health system, which understandably that they didn't think that necessarily is going to change their access because there are fundamental social issues that we have to address. So, mobile technologies are everywhere. I mean, barely you can see someone that doesn't have a mobile phone. Anybody in this room doesn't have a mobile phone? No. You know, I've been in 2008, I was in Somalia, a part of Somalia, and I can tell you almost like 60% of the population had a mobile phone for the same reason, because it was really a very nice form of, you know, having access to information and communicate with the people around. mHealth has been used for hypertension, diabetes, and improving the, keeping the appointment, adherence to medication, and improve the clinical outcome. You know, the data is not great, but we are in that direction. And certainly this mHealth could be used to address some of the medical needs of the homeless. There are already potential services at the shelter level. You know, there are caseworkers, and usually they communicate with the homeless in order to basically get their housing and apartment and all of those things. So we can tap into that and bring text messaging and mHealth to improve their access, reinforce peer education, they can communicate to each other and facilitate making medical service referrals, get them to their appointment and make sure they get everything. And I think that the ability of this system in order to make the communication a two-way communication, so they can communicate with the providers, and they can also they can keep a record of that, what has been discussed as a part of the medical record, would be very nice. So the mHealth platform could be very effective in improving the knowledge and access to care for a largely mobile population of the homeless, obviously because of the significant amount of barriers they face, and that can help us to avoid missed opportunities for health education, regular care and checkup and preventive care. And I think it would be nice to have some policies to improve their access to mobile health.